From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. A new CNN poll finds that climate change is the top issue on the minds of Democratic voters. 82% of survey respondents told CNN that they think it is very important that the Democratic candidate for president support taking aggressive action to slow the effects of climate change. And sure enough, some would-be Democratic nominees are making climate change a signature issue. Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, and Elizabeth Warren have all outlined plans. And that suggests that climate policy is likely to play a much bigger role in the 2020 elections than it has in the past. So let's dive deeper into what Americans are thinking when it comes to climate and what kinds of policies voters might support. Joining me now is Ed Maybach. He is a university professor at George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication. In December of 2018, that center released three major reports about public opinion on climate change and energy issues. Ed, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Heather.
You've been tracking public opinion on climate change issues for years. Are you at all surprised that climate change appears to be moving ahead of issues like universal health care or gun laws that have been major voter issues for years?
There are lots of issues that voters feel very strongly about that end up not being terribly decisive in elections. That has certainly been the case with regard to climate change in the past. I think the most recent election, the 2018 election, was the first time when climate change really did play a significant role in a national election. But I think that the current data suggests, and certainly the behavior of current candidates for the Democratic nomination strongly suggests, that this will be the first national election where climate change ends up playing a major role.
Well, where do we stand right now, just in terms of the percentage of Americans who actually understand that climate change is real, that it's caused by humans? You know, where do we stand with that public understanding of climate science?
Over the past 5 years, we've seen a real sharp uptick in public understanding of and public engagement in the issue of climate change. So I used to say that it was the case that most Americans understand that climate change is happening, but people tended to see it as a distant issue, distant in space, meaning they saw it as happening somewhere else, not here in their community, or possibly not even here in our nation, distant in time, maybe the year 2050 or 2100, but certainly not 2019, and ultimately distant in species, harming plants, penguins, and polar bears, but people didn't really see it as harming us, people. That has all changed over the past 5 years, and really our most current data collection, I just don't feel comfortable saying that anymore, because the about half of Americans now understand climate change as a here-now-us problem.
But that's not across the political spectrum. There is a divide between self-identified Democrats or liberal voters and self-identified Republicans or conservative voters when it comes to these issues, right?
Actually, the bigger divide is not between liberals and conservatives. It's between moderate Republicans and conservative Republicans. And so the majority of moderate Republicans actually do accept that climate change is happening and are growing increasingly concerned about it. Even conservative Republicans are growing increasingly concerned about it, but it's only a relatively small minority of conservative Republicans who feel that way.
Well, Ed Maybach, it's one thing to hear that Americans understand climate change is happening here and now, and that they're concerned about it. It's another for that, as you've already mentioned, to translate into an issue that they are actually voting on. Based on your ongoing survey work, what do we know about Americans' attitudes towards specific policies? Let's start with something like regulations or limits on emissions. Where do Americans stand on that?
It really depends on how we ask the question and what specific policy we poll on. But almost regardless of the policy and almost regardless of how we ask the question, it's generally about 7 out of 10 Americans who say that they support climate solutions. And the really surprising thing is that there is a less of a divide between conservatives and liberals on support for climate policy than there is on support for whether or not human-caused climate change is even happening. It continues to be surprising to me every time I see that, But there are a lot of good reasons to care about climate solutions. Most Americans, regardless of where they are on the political continuum, they understand that fossil fuel-based energy is dirty energy, and that burning dirty energy to power our economy pollutes our air and our water, and that's bad for our health. So there are a lot of conservative Republicans who don't accept that the climate is changing, who nevertheless see a clean energy future as a better future.
As you're kind of describing there, renewable energy tends to get more bipartisan support when you ask people, should we be moving in that direction? But also, to your point, it depends very much on the structure of the policies. And in December of 2018, or in the reports that you released in December 2018, you asked Americans about two very specific policy approaches: the Clean Power Plan, which is more executive action and regulations to limit emissions, versus something like the Green New Deal, which is focused more on job creation and economic growth tied to moving toward a low carbon energy system. How different were the responses to those different types of policies?
They were different, but only to a small degree. So roughly 7 out of 10 Americans support the Clean Power Plan. We don't actually, when we ask people about it, we don't identify it by name. Rather, we describe the nature of the policy in a couple of simple, clear terms. And we've seen that level of support, for the past many times we've conducted the survey. So let's just say over the past 5 years, we've seen real strong support for the Clean Power Plan, or at least the idea behind the Clean Power Plan. But what was very surprising to us, because it was the first time we had asked the question, was support for the idea behind the Green New Deal. And what was so surprising was that about 8 out of 10 Americans said they support that idea, including well over half of Republicans, even 56% of conservative Republicans. And as you said, Heather, we asked that question back in December of 2018. That was before Fox News had sort of made it its mission to attack the Green New Deal. We're analyzing data from our current survey right now, and while I can't really talk about what we're finding, I can tell you that support for the Green New Deal among Republicans has dropped.
So when that policy is actually named and brought into a political spotlight, then we start to see some deterioration of what otherwise seems like a consensus among the American public that we should be moving in this direction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So once an idea becomes a target of political attacks, then, of course, support for that idea will become eroded by members of that party.
Ed Maybach, another type of policy that you have asked people about in your public opinion polling is carbon pricing of some sort, whether that's a carbon tax or a carbon fee. There are different ways that this can play out. But I mean, this is a market-based solution. What do people say to you about that type of approach to limiting carbon emissions?
Yeah, we've asked about public support for a price on carbon in a variety of different ways over quite a few years now. And again, just sort of simplifying what we find, it's about 7 out of 10 Americans say, yeah, that's a good idea. We assumed that public support for the idea would be higher if the revenue from the price on carbon was essentially returned back to the American people in terms of a rebate, a dividend, a tax reduction, a reduction on their income taxes, or in some other manner. But actually what we find is that support for the idea of a price on carbon is even stronger when a good portion of the revenue will be used to accelerate our transition to a clean energy future. In other words, people want to see that money reinvested in the American economy and in American infrastructure so that we can embrace that clean energy future at a sooner date.
Well, Ed Maybach, in the polling that you released in December, you also asked people what they thought about a whole range of other policy options. We've talked about a handful here: regulations, job creation, carbon pricing. What are some of the other popular ideas, and what are some of the things that your polling shows are really unpopular in terms of the policies for addressing or not addressing climate change?
Two of the most popular ideas, and again, the popularity cuts across the political spectrum. Idea number one is essentially investing, scaling up America's R&D budget, research and development for clean energy. And also very strong public support across the political spectrum for helping consumers And businesses actually adopt these clean energy technologies. So we ask specifically about solar panels and electric vehicles. Again, we see very strong support for that idea that let's use some of our public resources to make it more affordable for individuals to embrace these technologies.
One thing that we've seen in the past couple of weeks as Democratic candidates have started rolling out their plans are some plans that are really just nuts and bolts. Here's what we want to do in terms of emissions reductions and the types of policies. But Cory Booker has done something rather different where he has said environmental justice is going to be a focus of his campaign and would be a focus of his presidency. Any insights into what the American public might think about that angle of attack on this problem?
The question of whether or not this comes down to be a compelling argument to people, I think, depends on how the argument is articulated. So one of the things that I am most taken with right now is the way that the Sunrise Movement has changed the conversation about climate change in America, and particularly the way that, you know, really a relatively small number of school children have embraced the notion of striking by striking for the climate by not attending schools on Fridays. They are essentially making a justice argument. They're saying, hey, you adults who run our world, you're not actually awake at the wheel. And, you know, you are stealing our future from us. And that's not okay. So if you're not going to pay attention and get the job done, we're going to take over and get the job done for you. That's fundamentally an intergenerational climate justice argument. I find it to be a very powerful argument when it comes out of the mouths of young people. When it comes out of the mouths of other people, I'm not so sure it is as compelling. When members of low-income communities talk about climate justice, about the fact that they have been the communities least likely to benefit from our fossil fuel economy, yet they are the communities most likely to be harmed by our changing climate and by air pollution caused by dirty fossil fuels, that's also a very powerful argument. So I think when climate justice arguments are made, it's really the people who have the most skin in the game who are most credible and authentic as purveyors of that argument.
Ed Maybach, as we've already mentioned, when climate policies move into the political realm, public opinion can very quickly change based on pre-established political allegiances. And sometimes that means, you know, going back into the kind of camps that we've seen develop over the past decade or so, where Republicans tend to be less in favor of climate policy or even denying the problem, and Democrats really pushing for climate action. But we have seen in the past few months what seems like a pretty significant shift, or if not shift, at least some movement happening, where we're actually hearing Republican legislators talking about climate policies. Do you think that public sentiment is in a place right now where climate policy could be a significant issue, not only in the primaries picking a Democratic presidential nominee, but also in the general election next year?
I definitely do. In our polls, we ask people whether or not taking a pro-climate action position or taking opposing climate action would make a voter more or less likely to support a given candidate. And for several years now, we've seen that taking a pro-climate action position is a vote winner, definitely for Democratic candidates, but really also for Republican candidates. So I think it's a bit of an aberration. The fact that the current occupant of the White House is so clearly not interested in acknowledging the reality or the seriousness of climate change, and certainly not interested in addressing it. But I think the electorate, particularly the younger conservative electorate, they're just not really interested in that kind of pandering anymore. So I think we are at a moment where Republican candidates will recognize it's really time to step up and do the right thing here, if for no other reason, to keep their young voters with them.
Ed Maybach is a university professor at George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication, where they are conducting ongoing polling about public opinion on climate change issues. Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather.
Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's estimated there are just over 400 North Atlantic right whales remaining. They are severely endangered, and their numbers have been declining in recent years. The two main causes of death are both related to human activities. They're ship strikes and entanglement in fishing gear. And in particular, the lines that connect lobster and crab traps to buoys at the water's surface are major culprits in entanglements. Now, a federal advisory group consisting of scientists, fishermen, environmental advocates, and others has recommended new rules that would dramatically reduce the amount of rope in New England's waters. Joining me now to discuss the significance of this step is Scott Landry. He's director of marine animal entanglement responses at the Center for Coastal Studies. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The result coming out of the recent meeting of the take reduction team was an agreement, or an agreement to recommend at least, that the vertical lines from lobster and crab pots up to surface buoys be reduced by something like 50% in Maine's waters and 30% in Massachusetts waters. How significant could that be for the health and the future of the right whale population?
In theory, it could be very helpful. Reducing the amount of buoy lines in whale habitat is one of the main goals that many of the whale research and conservation community has. And what we mean by that is that almost all fishing gear out in the water is marked by buoys that float on the surface so other mariners can see where the gear is. And that's connected by long lines that run to the seafloor to whatever fishing gear is there. And as you get closer and closer to the New England coastline, you'll start to notice that the entire coastline is outlined in gear fields. Some are thicker than others, some are, you know, relatively light. But if you imagine a whale swimming into these gear fields, the more dense those buoy lines are, or the more buoy lines per square mile, that probably does increase risk. So if we can reduce the number of buoy lines, it should, in theory, decrease risk.
And how might that reduction actually be accomplished? Are we talking about just cutting the number of lobster pots in New England in half? Or are we talking about some sort of technical fix that might allow the lobster industry to continue what it has been doing, but with less risk to the whales?
In the take reduction team meeting, it seemed like all members were clear that it really would be up to the individual states to some degree to decide how that reduction would take place, whether that means that certain fishermen who are only fishing with single pots would trawl up, i.e. they would add more traps per buoy line. Other states might have other sort of strategies to reduce the overall number of buoy lines. But I think a lot of people agreed that the goal of this is not to reduce lobster catch or what lobstermen are able to catch. It's really simply to reduce the buoy lines and how they impact whales. So to some degree, it's probably going to be up to the states in their negotiations with the federal government to reduce how they see fit in their areas.
Another idea that has been talked about and recommended is reducing the strength of ropes so that they would break under tension, or actually putting breaking points into the line so that if a whale were to become entangled, the idea is that the line would part and the entanglement could fall away. As someone who goes out and cuts ropes away from whales and disentangles them, unfortunately all too frequently, how realistic an idea do you think that is?
Well, I do think it's realistic from the point of view of the fishery. So in other words, fishermen going out in the water and trying to use this gear. It does have to be tested, however. You know, there are serious, you know, safety concerns that the fishing industry is going to keep their eye on, and that's fully understandable. Now, when we go out and disentangle a whale, we often bring that gear sample, as we call it, back to land, and it's housed in a warehouse where the different communities can make use of that gear to do research. Some of that research included testing the strength of the line that we were taking off of whales. And what we did find is that there was a sort of a sweet spot at around 1,700 pounds of breaking strength that would allow most right whales to break the line. It doesn't necessarily mean that the whales are going to break free and not be entangled anymore. They might break free from anchor, but go swimming off with gear. But it did seem like there was a cutoff point at around 1,700 pounds. It's not perfect, but it is certainly something to keep an eye on. What we are worried about is that factor I just brought up before, that, you know, there could be a certain number of animals that swim off with this relatively weak rope. And that would actually make our life, in theory, more difficult, trying to disentangle a whale that whose gear is simply breaking off every time we get close to the animal. So we're trying to find a compromise where it does help the whales and does help the industry.
What is the process going forward here? Because this recent meeting of the take reduction team, this kind of advisory group, is making recommendations to regulators, federal regulators. But there's still a process for that to actually turn into any rule changes and then another process for those rule changes to actually take effect. So what happens next and how long a process is this?
Well, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the federal agency sort of in charge of take reduction or the reducing the amount of whales that are taken in different fisheries, they have a pretty swift timeline, and that's simply because this species is in crisis. We're at around 400, 410 right whales. That's been declining since 2010. The main culprit in this has been entanglement in fishing gear throughout their range, all the way from Florida all the way up into Canada. And so NIMS does seem to realize that their time is of the essence, and they need to move as quickly as possible. But the take reduction team does realize that their recommendation or their actual consensus on this proposal is going to be taken into account by NIMS, and they have to decide if that is going to be enough to reduce those takes. A take is sort of the euphemism for killing whales, whether it's through ship strikes or entanglements. And right now, we can kill less than one right whale per year, and we've been exceeding that number for decades.
I mean, we saw, 17, 18 deaths 2 years ago. This year has been better so far, but that's a far cry from one per year.
Yeah, it's a far cry from that. Obviously, you know, the population, in essence, is making up for lost time from the catastrophe of 2017. You know, in the years intervening, we had a calving season of zero calves that we know of, and this year to seven. Seven is better than zero, but it doesn't even get us close to making up what we lost, let alone making some gains. So NIMS has taken this to heart, and they realize that time is of the essence.
What are the other options in front of those federal regulators if, as you say, they don't take this recommendation and turn it into a rule? What are the other things that they could do?
Well, the take reduction team, which, as you mentioned, includes a whole variety of different people, everyone from the lobster industry to conservationists to researchers, and all the state and federal agencies, we discussed many different things. That included closures.
Just closing down the lobster fishery.
Well, not closing down the lobster fishery entirely, but targeting them to where were most prevalent. Now, the problem we have with that is that right now the distribution of right whales has been changing over the last decade. So our ability to predict where right whales are going to be is extremely weak. It actually always has been. So those kind of targeted closures are a real challenge. Other discussions included increasing the amount, or actually even starting the amount, of ropeless gear. So in other words, still going fishing, but just doing so with substantially less to no rope. So the National Marine Fisheries Service, or the federal agency in charge of fisheries and of whale conservation, they'll be considering a whole suite of different options, everything from area closures or seasonal closures, ropeless fishing gear, reduced rope fishing gear, and even weak rope fishing gear. There's a whole set of options that the federal agency can use to try to bring the number of takes down to a level that is sustainable.
Scott Landery is the Director of Marine Entanglement Response at the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. When it comes to sharks, great whites and the risk to human swimmers have dominated public attention in the Northeast recently. But there are hundreds of species of sharks in the world, and for most of them, in most of the world, humans are a far greater threat to the sharks than the other way around. That's why my next guest is working to establish a shark shelter in the waters around the Philippines. Anna Oposa is the co-founder, executive director, and chief mermaid of Save Philippine Seas, a nonprofit that aims to protect the Philippines' coastal and marine resources. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Anna, you founded Save Philippine Seas when you were, 23, pretty much fresh out of graduate school with no community organizing experience.
Yes,
why?
Exactly.
Why did you think that was necessary, and why did you think you were the one to do it?
So I actually co-founded it right after my undergraduate degree. I didn't have my master's degree then, and I was looking for a job, and I had so much free time, and I was doing a lot of volunteer work on environmental advocacy, and I found out about a massive illegal wildlife trade case that happened in the summer, well, the Philippine summer, so it was April, May of 2011, and I don't know, because maybe I had so much time, I couldn't sit still about this issue, and I kept reading about it, and I decided to write different government agencies about this issue. And I found other people online, because I was very active on Twitter and on Facebook, who were also like-minded and passionate about it. And we decided to get online and start a Facebook page called Save Philippine Seas. But at that time, it was really just supposed to be a social media movement. But 8 years later, we're still here.
And you're no longer working on just the illegal wildlife trade. You've got a host of issues. What are some of the biggest threats that you see to the Philippines' coastal and ocean ecosystems right now?
So the Philippines is the second largest archipelago in the world. We have 7,500 plus islands.
Wow.
So you can just imagine how difficult it is to enforce certain laws for the seas. The Philippines has pretty much I call it the center of biodiversity in terms of plant and animal species, but we also happen to be the center of adversity and just about anything illegal and destructive you can find in the Philippine seas. So in addition to illegal wildlife trade, there's illegal unregulated and unreported fishing, and we were also named as the third largest polluter of plastics in the ocean. So those are three already major issues that we find ourselves occupied with. So never a boring day.
Well, with all of the issues facing ocean ecosystems, why at this point focus your attention on sharks, particularly thresher sharks, but other sharks and rays, and really focus on trying to protect those species?
So in the Philippines, we have about 200 species of sharks, and right now, only 21 species are protected. And when you have 200 species, what do you do with the rest? You know, the ones that are not protected. And we don't have a policy right now that regulates or even looks after all the species of sharks. And the thing about sharks is that many of them are at the top of the ecosystem, but other species also are important in livelihood and maintaining the ecosystem, the marine ecosystem health. Like thresher sharks, for example, has changed the lives of communities in Cebu. 80% of the income of the community that I work in, which is called Malapasco Island in northern Cebu, comes from the diving industry around thresher sharks. So in this case, sharks are much more valuable alive than dead. And people in the Philippines, even if we're an archipelagic country, a lot of people are scared of the water, are scared of being in the water, and have this perception that sharks are dangerous. So we're trying to change the way people think about sharks, and also train people on enforcement and building their capacity in terms of enforcing laws.
Well, so what are the threats? What are the laws perhaps that are being broken? You mentioned that only 21 out of 200 species are protected, but what are the threats to those shark species?
So right now, there are multiple threats. One is plastic pollution, but we don't know yet the extent of how sharks are affected, although recently there was a whale shark that washed ashore with a lot of plastics in its stomach, and that's been named as the cause of death. But right now, shark fishing is highly unregulated. We don't have a lot of data on how many sharks are being caught and where, and and what the ceilings, the catch ceiling is for certain species. So we have no idea if it's sustainable or not. And right now, the way the government records it is just it's fish. But since sharks have very different biological requirements, you know, they reproduce at a much later stage and they don't have a lot of pups. It's not like little fish that, you know, have millions of eggs. A lot of sharks give like birth to very few babies. So these are biological considerations that need to be considered and that are currently not being considered. So we're working on collecting more data, but also teaching enforcers how to ID fish and then working with fishermen and youth and teachers and different stakeholders just to inform them the value of sharks in the marine ecosystem.
Well, Anna Oposa, one of the major initiatives that you and your group, Save Philippine Seas, are really focusing on right now is trying to establish a shark and ray sanctuary in the waters around the Philippines.
Yes.
What would that actually look like?
So in Malapascua, the place that I work in, it's actually the first shark and ray sanctuary in the Philippines, but that was established through an executive order. And the way the Philippine legislative framework works is that an executive order is passed by a mayor, which means if the future mayors don't like this law, they can always pass another one that overthrows it. So right now we're working on making it an ordinance, which means regardless of who's in power, the shark sanctuary will still be there. And what this looks like is connecting the different marine protected areas in the municipality so that when the sharks migrate from one marine protected area to another, they're going to be safe, but also creating a board, a management board with different stakeholders to make sure that the different provisions in the policy are enforced and that there's budget allocated for it forever. So in the ordinance, it will have a financing mechanism to support enforcement and education initiatives.
Anna Oposa, as you mentioned earlier, the group that you founded, Save Philippine Seas, started as kind of a social media movement and is now still very focused on what you, and I love the pun, call citizen. S-E-A.
Yeah, we're obsessed with puns a little bit. Yeah.
being good ocean citizens and really making this citizen-based, a social movement. Why do you think that's so important?
I think it's also cultural because in the Philippines, we're very passionate about what we call people power and having movements come from civil society. And I started Save Philippine Seas when I was very young. I was 23 and I had no, like you said earlier, I had no conservation experience. But I want people to understand that you don't need to have a degree in conservation to be able to act on an issue. I was a writer and I used that skill to reach certain people. I am a communicator and a storyteller, and I use those skills to tell the story of the sea, you know. And like I said, we Filipinos are so out of touch with the ocean, and it helps to have people talking about it. But it's not just communication, you know, like whatever skill you have, whether you're a graphic artist or an accountant or a scientist, we want people to understand that these skills are needed and it's an interdisciplinary field. So we always create opportunities for people to act on an issue, whether it's changing a behavior like, you know, reducing their use of single-use plastics, or if you go to our website, we have free open source toolkits where people can just download letters and write to their leaders, or we create events in like a brewery or a mall, because we want to get more people involved and for people to understand that conservation isn't just supposed to be for, you know, environmentalists or scientists. It's for everybody. When we protect the oceans, we protect our people.
Anna Oposa is the co-founder, executive director, and chief mermaid of Save Philippine Seas. She'll be speaking at the New England Aquarium on Thursday, May 9th at 7 o'clock. You can find a link to more information about that on our Facebook page. It's Living Lab Radio. Anna, thank you so much, and best of luck with your efforts.
Thank you.
Up next, planting a garden that can be home to wildlife. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Habitat loss is one of the greatest threats to the diversity of plants and animals on Earth. Parks and wildlands are an important tool for conserving ecosystems, but it turns out our backyards and even urban balconies can also play an important role. Naturalist David Mizajewski is the author of the book Attracting Birds, Butterflies, and Other Backyard Wildlife. It's a practical how-to guide for creating gardens that are not only beautiful, but also provide functional habitat for wildlife. David, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
So what we're talking about here in creating habitat gardens is almost more habitat restoration than what we would typically think of as flower gardening. What does it actually look like in the end?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. A wildlife habitat garden really is a kind of habitat restoration. But the beauty of this idea is that just like a conventional garden, there are literally thousands of different ways that you could create this wildlife habitat garden, depending on how much space you have, what your budget is, what your aesthetic is, what kinds of wildlife you want to attract. So, you know, you can create a wildlife habitat garden that doesn't look too much different than what all your neighbors' yards look like, or you can go really wild with it and you can create a very, you know, natural habitat looking kind of space. It's really totally up to you. If you follow the basic principles of providing food, water, cover, places to raise young, and you use native plants, that's really the core concept. And if you do that, regardless of the design aesthetic you go for, it's going to help wildlife.
Even if you've got, say, an acre, though, you're not creating, like your own little national park. You're probably not aiming to have major large predators in your backyard. What actually is the goal? What's a realistic goal for a wildlife garden?
Another great question. Yeah, when we talk about creating a wildlife habitat garden, the kinds of wildlife we're really talking about are things like songbirds, butterflies, bees, you know, maybe small mammals, foxes and squirrels and things like that, that can happily and safely coexist with human beings. We're not talking about trying to attract, you know, bears or mountain lions or, you know, even, you know, hoofed animals, you know, like moose or deer. We're talking about the species that can, again, really coexist with us. And here's the thing. There are so many species that really could utilize the space that we've kind of taken from them through our development. And the notion of creating a wildlife habitat garden really is kind of the epitome of that old saying, think globally, act locally. We're in a wildlife crisis right now. You know, we've lost something like 60% of the animal life on this planet in the last 50 years. Here in America, one third of species are at increased risk of extinction in the coming decades, including things like many songbirds. The monarch butterfly, for example, has crashed. There are bees that are getting listed as endangered. So there's a real opportunity here to give a little bit back to the wildlife that, again, used to live where we live. And it's as simple as just following some basic principles. And if we all did that, our cities and our towns and our neighborhoods not only, you know, can look beautiful and be functional for us, but they can actually become part of the local ecosystem. And that's a pretty powerful thing.
Are there examples of this scale backyard habitat gardening actually helping some of those endangered species you were just talking about actually recover? Do we know if this works?
Yeah, it absolutely works. And I should say, you know, and for most people, you're not going to have endangered species on your property. But there's definitely research that looks at, you know, comparing a conventional suburban yard, for example, to a yard that has been certified by the National Wildlife Federation through our Garden for Wildlife program for following these basic principles. And it showed that there's more diversity of species and 50% more actual wildlife present from one yard to the next. So it really does work. And, you know, part of the idea here is helping keep common species common. You know, most people are going to see relatively common species that, you know, are not necessarily going extinct or sharply declining. But I mentioned the monarch butterfly. You know, monarch butterflies in the last 20 years have experienced a pretty scary population plummet. These are the kinds of animals that can benefit from a wildlife habitat garden because they rely on plants. Just by putting some natives back in your yard, again, like milkweed, which is the only caterpillar host plant for the monarch butterfly, we can restore habitat, have a beautiful garden, and actually make a difference for species.
David Mizejewski, the book that you've written, Attracting Birds, Butterflies, and Other Backyard Wildlife, is a fabulous little book, a fairly concise, really practical step-by-step guide to getting started on habitat gardening. And of course, the first step is assessing what you have and where you would like to go with that. Without going through the whole checklist, which you do provide, a questionnaire and checklist in the book, what are some of the considerations if somebody's interested in maybe turning part of their property into a habitat garden? What should they be thinking about?
This is really the kind of question you should ask yourself whenever you're doing kind of a garden or a landscape project. But it's things like, you know, how big is my property? How much of it do I want to, you know, be managing or planting for wildlife or other things? What is the aesthetic of my neighborhood? You know, many people live in places where, you know, with HOAs, for example, and there's very strict rules on what your landscape can look like. Now, I would suggest that if you have really militant landscape ordinances like that, that are not friendly to planting anything other than lawn, I would say get involved locally, become an activist and speak up for native plants and wildlife and things like that. But, you know, you're going to have some constraints like that. Things like budget, you know, your physical ability to be out there gardening and things like that. These are all things you want to think about. And so how that might play out is, you know, you mentioned maybe you have an acre, a property that's an acre big, and right now it's nothing but lawn. You know, maybe you don't, you know, you don't have the time to go out there and really rip up the entire yard, and that's totally fine. You know, maybe you start with a, you know, a 10-foot by 5-foot bed of wildflowers in which you're going to plant a bunch of beautiful native blooming perennials, maybe some shrubs that are going to provide nectar to bees and butterflies and other pollinators, and maybe even hummingbirds through their blooms. And maybe later in the season, some of those plants are going to provide berries that are going to be a food source, or they're going to be, again, a caterpillar host plant, or when they go to seed, that's going to be a natural food source for the birds. It doesn't have to be your entire property. You literally can do it anywhere. If you can plant something, you can be helping wildlife, including in the middle of the city. I live in Washington, D.C. I'm right in the middle of the city. I've got a typical D.C. row house with just a little narrow backyard. And I have, you know, a few dozen species of native plants in my little strip of garden around my patio. And most of them are on the ground, but I've got a bunch in containers. And in fact, I was just out there this morning and there was a carpenter bee nectaring at a wild geranium that I have growing in a pot on my patio, you know, getting a food source. So you can really do this anywhere. And doing that first step of assessment will just kind of give you a roadmap of where you want to go with your wildlife habitat garden.
David Mizejewski, the book Attracting Birds, Butterflies, and Other Backyard Wildlife is, as I said, a how-to guide, but it also addresses people's potential concerns about this rather different way of approaching garden space, or even, as you mentioned, containers around an apartment in the city. What's the maintenance like on a habitat garden?
Well, again, it really varies depending on your individual space. So, you know, there's kind of a continuum in my mind, and I touch on this in the book, as far as how you go about planting or creating this wildlife habitat garden. So the key thing, as we've been talking about, first and foremost, is including native plants. That's really what the wildlife need to survive. And so you can choose for a kind of a conventional suburban landscape look and just, you know, put in native plants in your planting beds. And that's, you know, that's going to be a great habitat for wildlife. You could go all the way to the other end of the spectrum and go for a little bit more of a natural wild aesthetic, which again, the wildlife will love, but is not necessarily going to work for everybody. And by that, I mean, you know, having brush piles and having like a natural meadow or prairie garden that is going to be taller grasses mixed with wildflowers and things like that. But I'll say this, we have such a huge footprint in this country and in the world with the land that we humans kind of occupy. And that could be, again, with just some very simple changes and maybe, yeah, a little bit of a shifting aesthetic, viable, important wildlife habitat. 1 million acres is gobbled up by urban development in this country every year. And most of it is, you know, it's buildings, it's pavement, but it's also lawns and ornamental exotic plants that don't support anything. So even, you know, if you look at a typical yard in America. And maybe it does look green and it does look beautiful. But if you are overlay its habitat value to wildlife, you begin to rapidly realize that you might as well just have planted plastic plants if all you have is a lawn and ornamental shrubs. But if you take that same landscape design and you replace some of those with natives, it's going to immediately increase the habitat value. And when I do it and my neighbor does it and the community does it together, the habitat value increases exponentially. And that's where we begin to see actual impact on species and making our cities and towns green corridors and our neighborhoods connecting to the local park system so that animals have places to move across the landscape. And you really end up creating an ecosystem, even if your goal is just to see pretty birds. And that's totally fine. When you do that, you're going to inevitably help in the bigger picture as well.
Of course, you're talking about creating these gardens around our homes, and they are our homes. They are an investment that we want to protect. If you're talking about attracting a lot of insects, there can be concern about, well, am I attracting termites? And am I going to actually harm my home by attracting more of this wildlife? And for that matter, it's my home. It's where I live and my kids live and my pets live. What about space for us? How do you address those kinds of concerns?
Sure. And that's one of the things in the checklist in the beginning of the book to ask yourself, you know, do your kids need a lawn space to run around and kick the soccer ball? You know, do you live in an area where fire is a concern? You know, if that's the case, you know, that's going to dictate ultimately how you want to kind of create your landscape. And again, these are questions that apply to any yard or garden design, not just a wildlife habitat garden. So yeah, one of the very key messages is kind of what you said. You know, we love wildlife. We want to make sure it has a home and a habitat. We just don't want it living in our home. So one of the basic things, and again, this isn't specific to a wildlife habitat garden. One of the basic things everybody should be doing is making sure you kind of critter-proof your house and do a little check every year. You know, make sure that there are no gaps along your roof line where critters could get into your attic or along your basement or crawl space. Make sure that you have screens in your window. I saw a funny thing on Twitter the other day where somebody posted a picture sitting in her living room watching TV, and she looked up and there were two pigeons sitting on her bookshelf watching her. And I laughed, and my reply was, you know, it might be time to put screens in your windows because, you know, it's just a simple thing, right? I mean, so yeah, you want to make sure that you're not giving any wildlife an opportunity to get into your home. You know, again, if you're worried about things like termites, creating a wildlife habitat garden isn't going to create a termite problem in your house. Having decaying wood in your house is going to create a termite problem in your house. So yeah, you can create a little bit of a people zone around your home where, you know, maybe you do have some ornamentals and maybe there's a little bit of lawn. Although I would really encourage folks, if you do have lawn, is to have a natural lawn. Don't dump tons of pesticides and fertilizers on it. You know, lawns really are dead zones for wildlife, but if you have a natural lawn, at least all sorts of other plants are going to grow among the grasses and you're not poisoning the soil and the water with a lot of these toxic chemicals. So yeah, I mean, again, it's just part of your assessment process. And, you know, again, if you live in a fire zone, building a brush pile near your home is probably not a good idea. Again, if you live in the city like I do, I don't have a brush pile in my yard, which a brush pile is a project that I have in the book where you can kind of build a natural shelter by stacking logs and branches and basically making all sorts of nooks and crannies and crevices for lots of wildlife to get into. But here in the city, if I built that in my yard, it likely would attract rats. So I don't have that particular feature. And that's okay. Like I said, there's so many different ways that you can implement those four components of habitat depending on what works best for you. And they're food, water, cover, and places to raise young.
That's David Mizajewski. The book is Attracting Birds, Butterflies, and Other Backyard Wildlife from the National Wildlife Federation. David, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. This week, we're saying goodbye to an intern who's been with us and been really instrumental over the past month. We want to say thank you to Lexi Krupp and best of luck as you move ahead with your career. We expect great things. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.